I'd like to invite you to take your Bibles and, if you will, turn to Ecclesiastes chapter 1, the book of Ecclesiastes. We'll begin with the first chapter and verse 9. That which has been is what will be. That which is done is what will be done. And there is nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which it may be said, see, this is new? It has already been in ancient times before us. There is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of things that are to come by those who will come after us. An old Texas preacher who literally rode on horseback across the West to preach the gospel, late in the 1800s, often ended articles he wrote with the warning, "Brethren, we are drifting." Such seems to be the tendency of man. Nothing new under the sun. We forget the past and just assume that what is currently done has always been done that way, as in Ecclesiastes 1 and 9 through 11. Some changes are rapid and noticeable, but many of them are not apparent because the drift covers spans of time greater than individual lifetimes. An example, case in point, the use of mechanical instruments of music in worship. Really, when it comes down to it, there is no debate in this matter. The fact is that the early church only sang in their meetings for worship. In Ephesians 5 and verse 19, we're admonished, speaking to one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing and making melody in your heart to the Lord. Nothing about a mechanical instrument. In Colossians 3, verse 16, let the word of Christ dwell in you richly in all wisdom, teaching and admonishing one another in psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs, singing with grace in your hearts to the Lord. Now, early Christians who wrote about what was going on were quite prolific in writing about the absence or the notable absence of instrumental music in the worship of the early church. One example of them is Clement of Alexander. Now, this man wrote around 195 A.D. Putting this in perspective, we're talking about less than 100 years from the death of the last apostle, roughly. And listen to what he said. I quote, "The one instrument of peace, the word alone by whom we honor God, is what we employ. We no longer employ the ancient psaltery, trumpet, timbrel, and flute," end quote. Now, granted, I want to make note of this, that's an uninspired man speaking, but that's a man simply observing what went on in 195 A.D. We also find Eusebius in the 4th century in his commentary on Psalm 91, and he wrote the following, "Of old, at the time those of the circumcision were worshiping with cymbals and types, it was inappropriate to send up hymns to God with the psalterion and the kithara, and to do this on Sabbath days," that is, breaking the rest and transgressing the law concerning the Sabbath. "But we, in an onward manner, our inward manner, keep the part of the Jew according to the saying of the apostle," referring to Romans 2:28 and following, as we know it. "We render our hymn with a living psalterion and a living kithara, with spiritual songs, the unison voices of Christians would be more acceptable to God than any musical instrument. Now, keep in mind, we're talking about the 4th century. Accordingly, in all the churches of God, united in soul and attitude, with one mind and in agreement of faith and piety, we send up a unison melody in the words of the psalm. That is, end of quote. It took nearly 700 years. Nearly 700 years. But eventually, the Roman Catholics added instrumental music to their worship. Now, they would like to have you believe that it was always that way. But it took 700 years. And even at that, we note that the Greek Orthodox and certain Protestant denominations totally rejected it at its introduction. Totally rejected it. Now, you're saying, well, all the denominations use mechanical music. But listen to the words of some of their founders. A fellow by the name of John Calvin, whose name is significant because of his doctrine of Calvinism, as it's known, lived in 1509 to 1564. He was a founder of the Presbyterian Church. Now listen to what he said. Musical instruments in celebrating the praises of God would be no more suitable than the burning of incense, the lighting up of lamps, and the restoration of other shadows of the Mosaic law. Men who are fond of outward pomp may delight in that noise, but the simplicity which God recommends to us is far more pleasing to Him. Now, just a minute. John Calvin? Yeah, that's right. But he did not recognize the use of mechanical instruments of music in worship to God. Another Presbyterian scholar said that the church, although lapsing more and more into defection from the truth and into a corruption of apostolic practice, had no instrumental music for 1,200 years. 1,200 years. The Calvinistic Reformed Church rejected it from its service, or rejected it from its services, as an element of popery. Did you hear that? Listen to that. Even the Church of England, having come very nigh to its extrusion from her worship, it is heresy in the sphere of worship. That is a Presbyterian scholar writing in the tradition of John Calvin. But let's look around. Are there some more? What about John Wesley? Well, John Wesley lived in the 1700s, 1703 to 1791. He was the founder of Methodism. Now, listen to what he said. I have no objection to the instruments in our chapels, provided they are neither heard nor seen. In other words, if you're going to bring them in, fine, but keep them out of sight and don't ever make noise on them. Did you hear that? Brother Adam Clark, who was not a contemporary of Wesley, he became on the scene a little bit later. He died in 1832, but he was considered a Methodist scholar and a commentator. In fact, Adam Clark's commentaries are widely used by brethren even today, especially on the New Testament. They're very good commentaries. But listen to what he said. This is revealing. I am an old man and an old minister, and I here declare that I never knew them, that is, mechanical instruments, productive of any good in the worship of God, and have had reason to believe that they were productive of much evil. Music as a science I esteem and admire, but instruments of music in the house of God I abominate and abhor. This is the abuse of music. And here I register my protest against all such corruptions in the worship of the author of Christianity. A Presbyterian scholar by the name of Robert Breckinridge also wrote in an article dated 1851. Now this 1851 we're talking now. Protests against the use of instrumental music in the stated worship of God on the Lord's Day. He said it is the grand objection of the use of instrumental music in the manner herein objected to is that it is contrary to the express will of God as shown by his positive institutions for his own praise. End quote. Well, that's the Methodists and that's the Presbyterians. Is there more? Well, how about the Baptists? Charles Spurgeon, one of the greatest preachers the Baptists ever had. Spurgeon lived from 1834 to 1892. He preached to 20,000 people every Sunday for 20 years. That's before the days of television. Now that'll tell you what kind of popularity he enjoyed. He preached in the Metropolitan Baptist Tabernacle. And mechanical instruments of music were never, ever used in his services. When asked why, Spurgeon quoted from 1 Corinthians 14:15, I will pray with the spirit, I will pray with the understanding, I will sing with the spirit, and I will sing with the understanding also. And then he said, I would as soon pray to God with machinery as to sing to God with machinery, end quote. Now, these are scholars that these denominations hold in high esteem. But what do you find in them today? Mechanical instruments of music. And not just an organ or a piano, a full band. Full band. But one more for you. Our brethren tried to introduce instrumental music into the Lord's church. It was a major factor, not the only factor. I want you to notice that. Not the only factor, but a major factor that caused the division at the end of the 1800s, which produced the Christian church. You look around us these days, it's hard to find those who call themselves Christians who are not worshiping with instrumental music. Why? Well, it's been going on long enough that most people assume that's the way it's always been. And they just accept it. And you try to argue with them about it. And, well, it's always been that way. No, it hasn't always been that way. It has not always been that way. But let me share this one with you. The congregation at Richland Hills in Texas. It's in the metropolitan Dallas-Fort Worth area, added instrumental music services at the end of 2006. And they were only the first. In the words of J.D. Tant, brethren, we are drifting. But let's take another subject. And this subject is appropriate to the season. The subject of Christmas. Bruce Forbes, a professor at Morningside College in Sioux City, Iowa, published a book in 2007 called Christmas, A Candid History. And he did some very remarkable work in pulling together some history. He documented that the midwinter celebrations that took place in around December 25th predated Christ by quite a bit. For example, the Yule is the name of a midwinter celebration in Northern Europe that predates Christ. He notes that there were no Christmas observances for the first 300 years of the church. Did you get that right? 300 years. The first recorded association of Jesus with December 25th is found in an ancient calendar that's dated for the year 354. And the date was likely picked because it fell in the middle of three Roman midwinter celebrations. And by the way, the date has varied at different times through the years. Now, in the 1600s and 1700s, Christmas celebrations were banned in England and in New England, in the colonies, that, of course, were run by Puritans. The reason given was the early Christians did not celebrate Christmas. The celebration also had too many ties with Roman Catholicism that the Puritans came here to escape the pressure of. And they saw it, remember these are Puritans, they saw it as an excuse for way too much partying. Now, in colonial New England, it was actually illegal to celebrate Christmas, and it carried a fine. Congress used to meet on Christmas Day up until about the 1850s. New England schools were open on Christmas up until the 1870s. Businesses remained open through the 1800s on Christmas Day. In fact, you're going to love this one. Some churches would close their doors on Christmas lest some tried to make it a religious holy day. That's right. That's right. Major American denominations such as Presbyterians, Baptists, Quakers, Methodists, Congregationalists either ignored the holiday or actively discouraged it up until the 19th century. And you're sitting here thinking, huh? How could this be? There's always been Christmas. No, there hasn't. What was the thing that marked the change? And you're going to love this. And I didn't know this until I read this material myself. It was Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol. Really? That's what it was. It was Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol. It became an acceptable family-centered holiday without an overtly religious significance, thus breaking the concern of connections to Roman Catholicism. The mainline Protestant churches learned to accommodate Christmas. But the change came from the pews rather than the pulpit. Think about that one. In other words, the leaders in denominations caved because the demand was so great. So, what do we have? Well, like ancient Israel of old, the people loved to have it so. That's what happened. Notice in Jeremiah 5, verses 30 and 31, an astonishing and horrible thing has been committed in the land. The prophets prophesy falsely. The priests rule by their own power. And my people love to have it so. But what will you do in the end? Like Paul warned, people will flock to those who will tell them what they want to hear. The time will come, 2 Timothy chapter 4, verses 3 and 4. The time will come when they will not endure sound doctrine, but according to their own desires, because they have itching ears, they will heap up for themselves teachers, and they will turn away themselves from the truth. Now listen, and turn aside to fables. That's what's happened. This is how we have ended up with a so-called dichotomy of two approaches to Christmas, both secular and religious. And modern Christmas is especially a cultural thing. And you notice it's different in different parts of the world. People do things differently. But the result today is that we have kind of a two Christmas situation. We have, as they call, a Christian Christmas, and we have a cultural or business Christmas. And a lot of people do both. And some people don't do any. Philip Ross, who was an elder at the Covenant Presbyterian Church. Now, this is really interesting. And this is today. Now, he's an elder at the Covenant Presbyterian Church in West Virginia. He said, I have a love-hate relationship with Christmas. It seems obvious to me there's nothing scriptural about it, but it's a hard sell with the children. But of course, people forget all about history. And what do we see? What is the big push? We have people pushing for putting Christ back into Christmas. That's the place Christ never was. He never was there. Christmas is a man-made holiday originating with Roman Catholics who wanted to put a religious slant on existing celebration so they could attract the heathens. And they did. They did. It's been rejected for centuries. And really, comparatively speaking, if you put all the facts on the table, just recently it has become popular to celebrate it. But the average person thinks it's always been celebrated. Why? They take it all the way back to the first century. But it's not found there. It's not found. This is an example of something that we need to keep in mind. If you remember, Israel of old was destroyed by lack of knowledge. In Hosea chapter 4 and verse 6, my people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. Because you have rejected knowledge, I will also reject you from being priests for me. Because you have forgotten the law of your God, I will forget your children. We don't want to allow ourselves to drift into these things. I just totally slipped my mind, but I'm going to slip, because I have enough time. I'm going to slip this one in. In today's world, these churches that have instrumental music, don't be surprised if you find a pagan bush sitting in them. Because they accept the traditions of Christmas just like everyone else who thinks it always was. But it wasn't. It wasn't. And that's why we don't observe it. It's not a religious holiday. Is it a civil holiday? Yeah, it sure is. I suppose most of you are getting off work. Most everybody does. I probably the firemen are not, and policemen are not. But you get off work. You have family traditions that you observe. That's wonderful. But it is not a religious holiday. Period. And that's why we don't do anything to observe it as a church. We need to be sure that we don't fall into the habit or the category, I should say, the category of those who embrace traditions and innovations that are of recent origin, really. But instead, we must listen to God and His Word. Jesus said in Matthew chapter 15, verses 8 and 9, "These people draw near to me with their mouth and honor me with their lips, but their heart is far from me." Now listen to what the problem was. "And in vain they worship me, teaching for doctrines the commandments of men." That's what's involved in instrumental music and worship, in the observance of Christmas as a religious holiday, the doctrines and commandments of men. And it makes our worship vain, worthless, empty.